Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Jay Baruchel, an actor you know from 2 decades of vivid performances in movies and television shows like Undeclared, Almost Famous, Million Dollar Baby, This Is the End, Man Seeking Woman, the Goon films, which he co-wrote and co-produced. He also directed the second one, Last of the Enforcers, and of course he was the voice of Hiccup in the How to Train Your Dragon movies and television spin-offs, and he's fantastic in those. Last week he released his second directorial effort, Random Acts of Violence, an adaptation of the comic book by Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray about a creator of horror comics confronting a wave of brutal murders inspired by and possibly connected to his own work. It's not what you think it's going to be. Jay picked Tyrannosaur, the brutal 2011 drama that marked the directorial debut of the actor Patty Considine, starring Peter Mullen as a violent man who finds himself drawn to an abused woman played by Olivia Colman. It's a harrowing and unforgiving portrait of rage and compassion. And as you'll see, it really hit home. This is Someone Else's Movie.
Few movies have, for lack of a less hokey or pedestrian term, affected me as directly and consistently as Tyrannosaur in my adult life. It was weird. I saw it. I saw it at TIFF, but not at TIFF. What I mean is, I was at TIFF for something, and I forget what movie it was, but I was in my hotel room, and I had some time to kill, and I put on Tyrannosaur.
Okay.
And it was something I watched, I think, between interviews, maybe.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And goddamn, I thought about it every single day for pretty much the next year. And when I first watched it, like, it's obviously a deeply confrontational film, and not pleasant, nor is it intended to be, those confrontations. And so my immediate reaction to it was discomfort and displeasure, and it made me mad. But it ended in what I think is that rarest of things. It ended in a sincerely beautiful way. And afterwards, I remember saying, well, God, I don't know the next time I'm going to watch that thing is. And it stuck in my head. And I kept thinking about it every single day. And then, you know, I went on and watched a bunch of other movies and consumed media as one does. And nothing stuck around like that. And I found myself a year later still thinking on it and asking myself the questions that the movie asks, it, you know, of its audience and of its characters. And I just found myself kind of, even hokier term, meditating on it a great deal. And then I did the thing I didn't think I would do, which is I watched it again and again. And I, you know, if I could find someone to watch it with me, which was sometimes a big ask.
I felt
a responsibility and a moral obligation to let them know what they were about to see.
No, I've had those situations, and it's awkward, right? It's like you're going to see something that's really overwhelming, but I think it'll be worth it in the end. But how do you sell people on something like that?
Basically, I let them know it's going to be really, really harsh, and it's going to it's not going to be an easy watch. But that, trust me, as hard as it gets, that it will end in a truly hopeful and sincere way. Because I think that the ending of that movie ultimately says some really beautiful things about the human condition. It just makes you earn the fuck out of them.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
To get there, I think. And I think one of the things that I kept thinking about the most is I remember when I was a kid reading a quote about, it was like a George Lucas quote about lazy storytelling. And it was something that's a lot of moving parts as a sentence, but he was making a point about how, it's really easy to make an audience hate a villain. First time they're on screen, have them kill a kitten.
Right.
And I was like, to have a movie where the protagonist kills a dog in the opener and I still take the journey with him and give a shit about what happens, fucking hell.
Yeah.
That's like, and I was like, and it was all compounded by the fact that I was already a big fan of Considine as an actor since Romeo Brass.
Sure.
And he was one of my favorite guys to watch. And then when I saw that he got to make a movie like this, I was like real psyched. And that's the last kind of thing I want to say about that initial reaction is I was utterly floored at how confident and restrained and assured a first film this is, you know. He has such a sense of his own voice, and with no runway leading up to it, you know, like it often takes people a few movies to find their voice the way that he found it in his first one.
Yeah, it's a really, I had a completely opposite experience of watching it than you did, because I saw it and then immediately interviewed Considine at TIFF. Mm-hmm. And so I got to expunge it. I got to ask all those questions and sort of deal with the meanings and the tension and everything and just get it all out. But my favorite part of this story, and no one believes me, but it's true, I even put it in the piece, is that the day before, I saw the film like a couple of days before the interview was scheduled. And then the next day, I was at Silver Snail, just because I was around the corner from the old location was down by TIFF at the Scotiabank. Right. And I'm around the corner, so I drop in because the new Buffy comic was out and I am that guy. And Considine is there buying Japanese toys, like just an armload with this big idiot smile on his face. And so I sit down the next day and I'm like, that was you, right? You were buying those. It's like, oh yeah, I love that stuff. I always come to Silver Snail when I'm in Toronto. And it's like, Tyrannosaur is how he gets to be that person. He gets it all out.
Yeah. Tyrannosaur gives you full Kawhi license.
Yeah, it's a purgative. And he said, like, I picked up the Blu-ray in the UK because, again, I wasn't sure I'd ever watch it again, but I wanted to have it just in case. Mm-hmm. And there's a booklet in the UK release where with director statements and artist statements, and it's great. It's this comprehensive package. And Considine says, like, this is a movie he made to understand his father and empathize with his mother. Right. And that also puts so much of it in context, right? I mean, we open with I have this rule about Peter Mullen, which is that if you see him show up in a movie, things never get better. This is the one movie that breaks that rule.
That's a pretty strong rule of thumb. That's definitely borne out by the
absolutely. The yeah, I mean, think about like Children of Men. 3/4 into the film, and you're like, this something's got to get better. And then Peter Mullen pulls up in a tank, and you're like, oh fuck.
Yeah, it's about to get a bit more harsh and grizzled. Yeah. So that's precisely it. And and he is such a bastard in that movie, and I still adore him. I adore that character, and it makes you feel that those great contradictions that I think a lot of movies just like movie storytelling seems to really likes to be or people like it to be, it seems to really simple and often binary.
Sure.
And I find that, you know, a characterization like his in Tyrannosaur is exactly what it is to be a human, which is you're going to have people in your life who fall into, at the very least, a gray area. You can have affection for somebody and really resent them, you know, and it spoke to me because, you know, the kind of cycle of violence and then guilt is something that I grew up around in a big way. You know, I was lucky that my dad never hit my mom, but I think that's because his dad hit his mom until my dad was old enough to kind of stop it. But he was still a really, really temperamental, often angry man, and he lived to fight in bars and to fight anybody. And I would see him lash out. So even if he's not hitting my mother, a guy like that is not like blessed with always the best people skills.
Yeah.
I'd be used. So even if he wasn't hitting any of us, he'd still be a mean bastard and yell and lose his shit. And then, and then feel bad for it. And it's a cycle I've seen again and again replay itself in a whole bunch of men throughout my life. And then and then I worry about, like, is it something I inherit too? So, you know, just the cycle of temper and guilt, I think, of eruption and guilt, and, you know, and anything that makes me think about that stuff and allows me to see my father and all the contradictions that comes with, you know, that's like, rare is the movie that sort of tests me and gets me thinking, and because my dad's a perfect example of somebody that I have an equal amount of issues with, but I also adore the man, you know, and so it's hard not to see him when I watch that movie. And also, I had never seen Olivia Colman in anything before I saw that movie. And
really?
That was like my intro to her. And I was like, to me, that was the best performance I'd seen in anything in about a decade. And the other best performance was was Mullins. And it also, I'm sorry to go off on this tangent, but
no, please.
It moved me because it spoke to another piece of me, which is, so my dad was Jewish, but my mom was Catholic, and I was really raised around her family more than my father's, and that's just how it ended up happening. And I ended up in Catholic school, and, you know, my mother felt obligated to you know, make sure that we understood and respected and experienced dad's side. Dad didn't really care one way or the other. His faith was his faith. But I mention this because one of the big kind of deciding factors, one of the big pieces in me that influences and informs everything is a very kind of deeply Catholic sense of shame, and then the beauty of forgiveness, and this is something that is kind of drilled into you when you go to church and you're in Catholic school, is that, like, nobody is beyond forgiveness, and that like anybody can be a good person if they seek redemption, and that movie says that to me, and in a really authentic, not sort of syrupy or exploitative way. So whenever I can see, so something like that lands really heavy for me, because I think it's irresponsible to just say what's wrong with the world without showing how it can be good or beautiful or better.
Yeah, that, first of all, that wasn't a tangent at all. That was absolutely relevant. And yeah, it's, I was going to say, my take on the film is that I had originally, like when I talked to Considine, we talked about the history of British cinema and miserabilism and the way that there are things that there are traps you can fall into, right? Which he doesn't. But
that's a good point.
Yeah. And he pointed out that it was absolutely different. He doesn't see it as related in any way to Lo Chi-Li, because there's no social realism in it. It's just about the people. And as a result, I think it's a much more actively, even though I don't think the church is ever mentioned either, I guess there's a charity shop kind of feel to it. There's a sense of community.
Yeah, she mentions Christ in prayer, or the Lord, but that's about it.
But he doesn't go to, like, there's no big speech, there's no big church moment. But it is a really Catholic movie. Like, or Sea of E, maybe? Like, it's wrestling with a lot of that stuff.
I think so. I think it's like, I certainly knew that, I felt that it dovetailed with all of the good and bad that I feel towards that church. I can't go to that church for a bunch of reasons, but not the least of which is, A, they believe my dad went to hell just by virtue of being Jewish. And B, they've betrayed generations and generations of their flock, of their weakest, most needy of their flock. And I can't suffer that. However, I'd be lying if I said to you that I don't still, to this day, get a great deal of edification and merit from it. There is, for whatever reason, there is no place on earth I feel more safe than in the Catholic Church. It also, I pray every time I fly. It's informing in ways that I probably can't even put my finger on, but I also, I am deeply angry with it as well. And it's responsible for me, hating myself in a large way. And in addition to just being like sort of, taking issue with where it's at, it's also, it's done as much good as harm to me as a person. And that movie kind of reflected that. I really saw the best stuff that can come from it. But I also saw what it can do to people. And cause also that cycle, I'd argue that Catholicism informs that cycle. Cause so long as you can be forgiven just by repenting, that kind of, there's an implication of a slippery slope of carte blanche, you know, but at the same time, I don't think forgiveness is a nonsensical concept. And I do believe in betterment. And I think that people can become better and all that stuff. So anyway, so I think it is a deeply Catholic movie.
Yeah. But the difference to me is that it implies that forgiveness is hard, like it's work. You, like God might forgive you, but that's not what he's worried about. He's got to deal with the people in front of him and the world that he lives in.
Because it's harsh as hell. His buddy's daughter, his buddy that's dying, she doesn't let him off the hook once.
Yeah.
He keeps trying to get that from her and she won't give it to him. And because it's also something that like it asks an interesting question, which is something I've seen in my life with a bunch of different men, which is like violent men who become softies as they get older. And that's the sort of, that's biology and chemicals doing the work for them and forcing the issue. You inherently get more mild as you get older. And I wonder, you know, violent man that wants to sort of patch things up later and realizes the people he needs in his life, you know, is that actually him accepting what he's done, or is that the by his biology forcing the issue upon him, you know? And I see that kind of exemplified in those moments with his dying friend's daughter, who he keeps trying to kind of connect to her in a base kind of commiserating way, the way you do at a wake, the way you do at a funeral, where there's like an unspoken thing that we're not going to talk shit about each other or the person that mourned, and we're just going to talk about nice things, and she won't let him have it.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a super ballsy, brave, truly real thing to do in the movie.
Yeah, it's the time that Considine takes to sit in things, right? Like to just sort of make us share that discomfort and awkwardness. And we haven't even mentioned Eddie Marsan yet, but he is like, if anybody's a sinner in the film, he's the monster.
Oh,
but it's just such a horrible, unforgiving portrait of that man who is like, it's necessary dramatically to see how Coleman could be driven to someone else who is potentially just as bad or just as ruined by his life. But Marsan has this, I don't know if you've ever met him, but he's like the sweetest human being on earth. And he's like, his face is cherubic, right?
I've never met him.
Yeah. He's a lovely guy. And he has these eyes that just speak to empathy, and to watch him turn it off for this movie is just unnerving from the start.
Or use it in a different way. Cause I think that's part of what makes him such a truly scary monster, is that you understand, cause also you understand how she fell for him in the first place. You understand how he exists in the worlds he exists in. Cause also he does have his, he goes through that same cycle of eruption and then seeking forgiveness with her.
Oh yeah.
He beats the piss out of her and then talks about how shitty he is and how he knows he's shitty and he wants to get better. Right. And it's all, you know, I don't know that it's nonsense when he's saying it, but it ultimately ends up nonsense because he is who he is and he has no interest in changing. And then the movie, you know, it tricks you into thinking it's going to let you scratch that easy revenge itch that you're, that she's going to, or savior itch that, yeah. that, you know, she's caught between two pieces of shit, but our piece of shit's going to beat up her piece of shit. And no,
yeah.
no, he doesn't let us get that. And he shows us what this fucking shit does to people. And it's this heartbreaking thing of a woman who wants nothing but good. She wants nothing but good and love and happy. And she puts it in there and she keeps putting it out into the world and the world refuses to let her have it. And it breaks the fucking shit out of her. And Mullen just as much as her husband, you know, I would argue. And then he sees it. And I think that it's like it's this sort of doubling down and understanding that because he really relentlessly tries to break the Christ and the Christian and the believer and the hopefulness out of her.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he does, and he realizes that that's the fucking last thing he should have done. Yeah, it has some pretty important shit to say, I think, about. Yeah, about what we do to women, and how we kind of, yeah, the control structure dictates one of a few options for them, and it doesn't necessarily always leave a lot of wiggle room, and I just like utterly heartbreaking when she snaps, it is like. Yeah, it's because I've known, because that's the other thing is, you know, it's easy to shit on any organized religion, especially that one, you know, but I also know, having grown up in it, that for every fire and brimstone, for every person that makes you feel like shit about yourself, and for every hypocritical priest that preyed on altar boys, there's a bunch of people like my grandparents who were devout and went to church every Sunday and were legitimately good people. And so it lands on me in such an impactful way when I see her broken. That was like seeing somebody I care about who had no reason to stick around, but these beliefs and this faith allowed something of a spine or a fulcrum to rest their tenuous connection to reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I
take that away from them.
Yeah. I know a few people who are genuinely religious. And I think the worst thing about all of these church scandals is that it makes me question their motives. Like that you doubt the people who actually are trying to do good.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest tragedy is what happened. The second biggest tragedy is that it robs something that is meaningful in a sincere way. It robs it of legitimacy, and it makes it leaves a lot of people out in the fucking cold, man. And
yeah.
And I know a lot of Catholics who can't ever go back, and but they can't divorce themselves from the dearest memories of their childhood either.
Sure, yeah.
You know, that's every Christmas and Easter, that's First Communion, that's every wedding, that's, you know, that and because for me it's like this, I can never throw the baby out with the bathwater completely, because the best people I've ever known are my mom, my grandfather, and my grandmother, and they were all Catholics, and so I grew up going to church with them. So now, that doesn't change anything. It just means for me, it's a bit of a complicated process, and not something that it's not a limb I can easily amputate.
Yeah, no, I mean, we all have the baggage of our youth, right? We all have what we thought, what we were told was right because we didn't know any better, and then we learn it, that everything's much more complicated. And I do wonder if making Tyrannosaur was his way of dealing with all of those things as well. Certainly his own personal, like his history, his family history, but also the world he was raised in. Because he played a number of roles that engage with that, right? Have you seen My Summer of Love?
I haven't, no.
Oh, he's in that. He plays a recent religious conversion, basically, like a fanatical Christian soldier, opposite Emily Blunt and, I can never remember the other woman's name. It's Pavel Pavlikovsky's first film. It's feature. It's fantastic. That and Romeo Brass came out around the same time, and that was my exposure to him. And he seems like he's getting there as an artist and also as a person because of the choices he's made, like the performances he's given. And also, he's funny as hell. You know, like he's in Hot Fuzz with Coleman, which I think is the first time he pitched it to her.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, because they're both in the...
So I have a slight, like a way less impactful, but also kind of a neat piece answer. My own anecdote about the DNA of the creation of Tyrannosaur. So there's a really wonderful kind of musical interlude after they bury his friend, and it's everybody drinking together at the bar, and it is an authentic example of what Awake feels like. And it's Damien Dempsey is the artist that plays that has played over that sequence. And what's super cool is, so I'm 2-3 years ago, we shot a movie called Random Acts of Violence. And,
yes.
And my driver on that movie is a lovely man called Jerome McCann from Northern Ireland. And he's a big Damien Dempsey fan. And he was playing in the car, and I recognized the song. I was like, wait, that was in Tyrannosaur. And he looks at me wide-eyed. He's like, you know this song is in Tyrannosaur? I was like, yeah. He's like, let me tell you something. He's like, 10 years ago, years before Tyrannosaur was made, I was driving Paddy Considine on a movie here in Toronto, and I was playing this song in the car, and he asked what it was, and I told him who it was and what the song was. And then, lo and behold, a few years later, he makes Tyrannosaur and puts that song in the movie. So, yeah, so it's a kind of a neat bit of, like, yeah, Jerome happened to be playing Dempsey in the car. Considine heard it and was like, oh, this is something special. And at least that was what Jerome, that was the anecdote. But it's still, like, kind of a neat piece. So when you told me that, you know, he probably first pitched it to Coleman on the set of Hot Fuzz, I live for those, for that, that's in the scope of movie history, that's my favorite kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, and I believe too that he would be vacuuming up, because it's his first feature, right? It's like your first novel where you put everything in. He would be taking little bits and pieces from all over the world wherever he goes, and he's, you know, as an actor, as you know, like you're in a perfect position to just go around and sponge up the world.
Absolutely, and a film is an inherently collaborative endeavor.
Sure.
It's not a novel. A lot of directors treat it like it's their fucking novel, but it isn't. And it should have the fingerprints of everyone involved on it. And so that's the most special thing in the world, when you can get a piece that didn't occur to you from someone else and you see it can inform and increase something you're doing. That's the most special thing. But yeah, I think you're right about what he's unpacking. I certainly saw all that stuff, and for me, you know, from growing up, you know, we did 5 years in Oshawa, and that was when my family was at our poorest. And between the men that I grew up seeing, and the church that I grew up going to, and then, you know, my father as a violent man, I certainly saw a lot of my life and childhood in that movie. So I can only assume that he's unpacking even more of the same shit.
Yeah. And to that end, it felt like there's a lot of personal, maybe bruising is a word that I can use for Random Acts of Violence. It feels like you're dealing with, there is some domestic stuff in the flashbacks, and the way that you handle it is kind of unforgiving. And the depiction of violence is, I don't know how many people will have seen this by the time we talk, so I want to be vague about it, but there is a progression to the way that violence is depicted in the film, that it's it's awkward and brutal, and it's not stylish. It's stylized towards the end, but it's not pleasant for the audience in any way, and it feels like you're really dealing with what pain is instead of
Well, I'm glad you noticed that, because that was something we took great pains to do. We really I wanted to take the entertainment out of it for a few reasons. There's my sort of intellectual bleeding heart and moralizing arguments, reasons for it. There's also a very utilitarian one. My sort of personal ones are, I think that I didn't want to make the movie that we made with the dialectic that we kind of attempt in it, and then undo it, all of it, by making something sort of outlandish and over the top. And the whole thing is about a guy having to lie in the bed he's made. He's trafficked in the victim experience and mined it and wallowed in it and exacerbated it and crystallized it for the sake of, like, he would call it his artwork, others may not. And I want to say, what is someone who traffics in victim exploitation, what does it look like when they have to become one? And it should be deeply unpleasant. And it should, because in real life, if ever you've been out and about and a bar fight happens or a car wreck happens, the biggest thing it does is it robs us of the music of the social contract. We all have kind of an end of the bargain to keep up. I pay taxes, I queue up, I hold the door open, I walk at this pace, not at that pace. Sure. I don't cut someone off, all this shit. And then a car wreck or a bar fight happens and that music stops. And it's now playing at its own fucking music that none of us can hear. And even the people involved in it can't hear, because it's improv and you don't know how long it's going to go on for, which connects to the utilitarian reason to do it like that, which is, if I, watch something crazy happen to a body that can't actually happen in real life, I'm feeling a lot of different things. I'm feeling adrenaline. I'm feeling shock. I'm like but I'm not scared. There's nothing scary about that, It's like, holy frig, but it's not like, I think about watching a movie, when I'm legitimately scared, it means I'm questioning whether I should continue watching the bloody thing. That's actually scared. And that's, so that's the utilitarian reason to do it that way. But I also was trying to fucking articulate some shit that I'd lived through and know people that had gone through. And it's an unpleasant thing. It's a deeply horrendous, unpleasant thing. And so I wanted it to, I'm so happy you noticed it was fucking clumsy, because that was the biggest thing, was I want to bury the choreography as best as possible. I want it to be as start-stoppy, clumsy, instinctive. And also because, what are the control dynamics, the power dynamics in a kill in a horror movie? Well, they stem from the killer monster up down. And if the killer and or monster, whatever you want to call it, if he is as prey to his own emotions as his victims are, if he doesn't know where the fuck he's going to go, well, then you're dealing with a rabid dog. And boy, you have control is the so far away from it, because you're just trying to figure out what the hell the next thing is going to be, right? And so it's also, as I'm sure you saw, there's also a whole bunch of Catholic shit in there, too.
I noticed a little, yeah. I don't have quite the reference, but I got some of it.
But, it's because that's the other thing. Catholicism is a deeply gory religion.
Body and blood.
As a child, you grow up seeing artwork and iconography of torture and you see Christ mutilated from your earliest memory onwards, and they drill it into you that he wasn't just mutilated, he was tortured. And so this kind of like, it's hard for me to kind of separate gore from awe and majesty, and that doesn't make it pleasant. pleasant. It just makes it impactful.
Yeah, I think you found a really good way. I mean, there's a moment, maybe I'm going to say 20 minutes into the film, where I started, again, not to say anything about the plotting, where I realized, oh, the movie's not going to behave. Like, this isn't going to take the path that I thought it was going to take. And now I'm off my footing and I don't know what's going to happen next. And that was, it was jarring. And I wish I could see this with an audience just to feel how they react. It is so, it's a risk that might not pay off. And so to watch this thing fishtail consciously through its tone was really interesting. And was the film the kind of, like, do you feel like you got the same thing out of making this that Constantine presumably got out of Tyrannosaur? Do you feel like you're on a different path now? Or an exorcism?
Cool. Yeah, well, that's so nice of you. That's a really cool question. I know that I'd like to think so, but I also, you know, I treat every movie as feast or famine, it's always an if. I don't assume anything. So all I know is I got to make the movie that I wanted to make, and that's a rare thing. And that nobody, because it was the right size, it was just big enough that we had barely enough resources to do something, but not big enough that anybody was breathing down my neck. And
right.
So that meant that, you know, and at the urging of my artistic conscience, Kareem Hussein, we really just decided, you know, we took the approach, we might never get to do this again, so we might as well just do the thing we think we should do. And the thing I'm most proud of, for whatever it's worth, is that people have a hard time describing this movie, even the ones that like it.
Yeah.
And that's like, how often does that happen, man? You know, and I'm like, that in itself, I'm happy that I made something that I think is like confrontational and honest. And I think it's also leaves people with some questions. So I'm deeply proud of it. And it is like, if nothing else ever, if I never get to make another movie, I got to give the world an example of my subconscious, you know, as true an example of it as I could ever muster.
That's a pretty good explanation of it. I mean, that's a good way to describe it. I just wonder how many people will be able to see, like, not to see it, but to share it, like, this is what you were saying about Tyrannosaur, right? Like, how do you explain what you're about to show people?
Yeah, and I just try to tell, you know, that's exactly it. What's so far ended up happening with audiences is exactly what I had hoped, which is if they don't dig my flick, they absolutely hate it and question my right to make a movie. And that was what I wanted. If somebody fell asleep to this movie on Air Canada, I would be heartbroken beyond repair. And the people that dig it, dig the stuff that I dig about it. And that's the coolest thing I can say about it.
My thanks to Jay Baruchel, whose second feature, Random Acts of Violence, is available on digital and on demand right now in Canada and coming to the US and the UK August 20th. Keep an eye out for it. And thanks to Kate Parks. She knows what she did. You can find Jay on Twitter at BaruchelNDG, all one word, and you can find Tyrannosaur on DVD from Strand Releasing in the US and Alliance Films in Canada. It's also streaming on Hoopla and Canopy in the US and on Hoopla and Amazon Prime in Canada. If you have a region switchable player, the UK Blu-ray is terrific and it's really cheap at Amazon right now. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I host a bunch of podcasts as well as writing about film and television. Go check that out. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. They're good. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask. See you soon.